This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And yet, yes, this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we are at our new time, Monday morning at 11 o'clock, rather than Fridays at 9. So if you are confused by the time, you are absolutely with us. Here it is, Monday morning at 11, and we are giving you The Deep Dive. After a couple of weeks away from broadcasting, I didn't go anywhere. I had a Johannesburg staycation, but my daughter from Cape Town came up to Johannesburg with her new baby, a now six-month-old Koa Maxwell Spector. Okay, now there's nothing like a six-month-old child to take over a household with everybody running around trying to solve things. It was much easier than a vacation would have been. Invited relatives from all over the place to come in and admire the new baby. And I must tell you, the child smiles beatifically at everybody, laughs, giggles, goes to any outstretched hand. He is a natural charmer. And I look forward to being able to give you reports when he starts to walk and talk and engage in political analysis. And today's guest is David Smith. David Smith is no stranger to our airways. He is the Washington correspondent for The Guardian. He spent years in South Africa covering this country and Africa as a whole. And we enjoy having him come on the air periodically with us to help us understand the nature of the dynamics in Washington and the United States and as how they affect the rest of the world. And once again, here we are at the beginning of the year. It's entirely appropriate, useful, and correct that David will join us for our conversation. David, thank you for coming on the air with us. I know it's late in the evening for you. It's early in the morning for us, relatively speaking. But I know you're a night owl, so it's not a problem for you. Welcome, and thank you for joining.
Great to be here, and congratulations on being a grandfather. I don't know if this was the first time, but it's a great thing.
This is the first and probably only time, but Koa is now 6 months old, and he is irresistibly cute and attractive, and he smiles at everybody, and any moment now he's going to be an angry child trying to teethe. So that's how it goes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nature of life, right? Let's get right to it. Donald Trump versus Venezuela. Last year, when we looked at the news, there were threatening gestures and nasty statements. And then suddenly, in the middle of the night, helicopters descended on Caracas, and Nicolas Maduro was whisked off to the United States to stand trial. And a new acting president was installed in his place. And suddenly, the equation between the two countries has clearly changed. What was the purpose of this, really, besides newspaper headlines? What was going on in the mind of Mr. Trump and his advisors that this kind of action was undertaken?
Well, the short answer is oil. There is a longer answer as well, perhaps. And just to set the scene, welcome to 2026. I was, as a movie fan, you'll appreciate this. I was sitting at home watching Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino. My phone rang from a TV broadcaster saying there are bombs falling in Venezuela. Can we talk to you about it? So that was 2 a.m. local time here. And then I went on again at 4 a.m. local time, where there was still this drama and aircraft flying over Venezuela and bombs. And then I went to bed, and I'd been lying there for about 10 minutes when they called again and said the U.S. has just announced it's captured Nicolas Maduro, the leader of Venezuela. So I got up again and did not have much sleep that night. And This is the Trump era where, after a relative calm over Christmas and New Year, it explodes back into life with astonishing drama. Yes, since last August, the US had built up a big military presence off Venezuela, and it had been bombing small boats allegedly carrying drugs. So there were some elements of this not surprising, but it still came as a shock to everyone, the idea of the US capturing a foreign leader in such a dramatic way in a very well executed military operation. And the official line, the reasoning for that is to do with drugs. They accuse Maduro of being a narco terrorist, of basically killing thousands, if not millions, of Americans by enabling drugs to flood into the US. And when he appeared in court in New York, those were the main charges, really portraying him as like a drug kingpin. Who had, for example, facilitated flights carrying drugs and given falsified passports and been involved in arms trading and basically being responsible for this this flow of drugs. But Donald Trump has given varying and shifting explanations because in his immediate press conference afterwards and on Air Force One the next day and on other occasions, he's also framed this about oil and Venezuela's natural resources. It has the biggest natural oil reserves in the world. And just the other day, Trump said if you put the US and Venezuela together, they account for 55% of oil production. And Trump has been pretty blatant, pretty open about wanting US companies to move into that country and commercialize that oil, which will take a tremendous amount of time and money to get it flowing. And again, a couple of days ago, he's spelled it out. He said, you know, if we hadn't gone in, then China or Russia would have done it. So there was that motivation to take control.
Let me just dial back for just a like two sentences earlier. That although it's easy to say it was all about oil, when the Trump administration convened a semi-public meeting of heads of 10 or 12 major oil companies, after the meeting, the head of ExxonMobil, which is I think the largest oil company, maybe the largest company, period, on the planet. Said Venezuela is uninvestable. There is no way in the world that we're going to put any money into Venezuela until the legal system and the courts and stability and all the rest of this was totally revamped. And I've seen estimates that run between $10 billion and $100 billion worth of needed investment in Venezuela before it becomes even close to its previous pre-Hugo Chavez period of pumping of oil. And in any case, that oil is that heavy sulfurous acidic stuff that not every refinery can even deal with. So yes, it's about oil, but it's about oil in the mind of Donald Trump rather than in the reality of oil companies.
Exactly. I was in the East Room for that meeting between Trump and
Oh.
the oil and gas executives, J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, there too. And you know, Trump went around the room getting input from all those oil bosses who had to be very polite. But yeah, there's huge gaps in the logic of what Trump has done here. It's coming at a moment when the global oil price is already pretty low. And when the US has massively increased oil production in recent years and decades, it's now the world's leading oil producer. There's no great need for this Venezuelan supply that yeah, will be extremely logistically difficult to handle. I guess one thing Trump would say was what I mentioned before, that this notion that if the US didn't do it, then he fears China or Russia or both could have been operating there. And he talked about it, you know, they're a next door neighbor. We don't want China and Russia so close. But yeah, I think there are other factors operating here, they include everything from the farcical that Nicolas Maduro was allegedly mocking Donald Trump's style of dancing, and that might have annoyed him. Let's not forget Secretary of State Marco Rubio, son of Cuban immigrants. He takes a great interest in this. He was quite a hawk on Venezuela, and I think he sees a potential knock-on effect that if Venezuela is thwarted, then it will no longer be able to supply oil to Cuba, and perhaps the Cuban regime will topple as well. Maybe somewhere in there, Rubio hopes that will be a positive for democracy in the region, but Donald Trump has, I think, barely mentioned the word democracy in this context,
I'm not
in
sure
that
it's in his
sense.
vocabulary generally.
That's right. Even in America, as we've seen this week with rewriting the history of January the 6th. We have seen an interesting shift here from the Iraq War, which critics argued was also about oil, but in those days, the US at least pretended that it was about nation building and democracy, and Donald Trump has stripped away some of that hypocrisy. He doesn't even see the need to pretend.
Let's move northward. Let's get in that ship and sail due north of Venezuela until we run into a very large ice-covered, snow-covered island called Greenland, which isn't very green. That's all right. That was advertising propaganda by Eric the Red in the 10th century, but never mind. The United States and the person of Donald Trump has decided that by hook, by crook, gently, firmly, or epically, Greenland shall be part of the United States because you can't control something unless you own it, which sounds like a real estate developer in Midtown Manhattan. The Danes and the people who live in Greenland, on Greenland, aren't quite as pleased with this concept as Donald Trump is. And in any case, as you know, and many listeners may, the U.S. already has the right to build military bases on Greenland, has one, used to be called Thule, and now it's called something I can't pronounce because there are no vowels in the name. And there are minerals there, but they're under, 2 miles of ice and snow, which makes it a little bit awkward. I'm just fascinated by the fact that 110 years ago, the United States decided that it needed the Danish West Indies, which was now the American West, U.S. West Indies, from Denmark, on the theory that the Germans during World War I might put submarines in the then Danish West Indies. And now here we are, 110 years from now, from then, and we're worried about the Chinese taking over Greenland. Once again, what is going on? Over to you.
I wish I knew the answer. I mean, I've heard diplomats from, say, the Obama era use phrases such as, this is total insanity. I mean, they cannot believe it. And as I speak to you in the last few hours, there's at least one media report suggesting that Donald Trump has literally asked US Special Forces to draw up plans for an invasion of Greenland. That's still unconfirmed, but it would chime with his rhetoric in the East Stream on Friday, where he was saying, we have to take Greenland, like it or not. He's becoming increasingly aggressive. And I think there's a fear that the success of the Venezuela operation may embolden him. And of course, he's been talking about this for a while. It was there a year ago when he was coming into the presidency. I think he mentioned it in his inaugural address. Again, he claims that this is a national security concern. And as ever with Trump, there's a kernel of truth that China and Russia are operating nearby. And so it's, to me, this is feeling very Cold War, this idea that you can warn of the dangers of China and Russia and then try to justify anything. And we've heard it with Venezuela and Iceland and Greenland as well. And yeah, it's hard to overstate just what a potential shock this is to Europe and especially NATO. The NATO alliance has been there since World War II, 80 years as a bulwark against Russia. The whole idea was if one NATO member is attacked, then it's an attack on everyone. Of course, this principle has only been invoked once after the September 11th attacks on the US itself. No one in their wildest dreams or nightmares imagined that one NATO member might attack another. And the Prime Minister of Denmark, which owns Greenland, has warned that if the US did attack Greenland in some way, then that's effectively the death of NATO. That's the collapse of the alliance, which would be truly world-changing and something that would please no one more than Vladimir Putin in Russia, of course. And some may speculate that's one of Trump's motivations here, because for a decade or so he's been pleasing Putin at every turn. Now, again, there's an analogy with Venezuela in that Greenland has notable natural resources, some rare earth minerals, gold, other things that, and I think mining companies have designs on it. So there's both national security and economic interests at play, but I think let's not underestimate Donald Trump's dreams of grandeur, his imperial ambitions, his neo-colonial ambitions. And the political commentator Max Boot observed the other day that, in 20 years we've gone from American neo-conservatives to now American neo-colonialists. And that's something that strike fear to the rest of the world.
Well, Max Booth is hardly what you would think of as a left-wing radical.
Indeed.
I'm just fascinated. I'm waiting for the plan. I'm waiting for the leaked blueprints or artist rendering of the first Trump International Hotel in Nuuk, which is the capital of Greenland. I can't
You don't have
wait for
to.
this.
Yeah, I mean, if you scout around on social media, you can already find a possibly AI generated video of a strip mall in Greenland with a McDonald's. And as some people wryly comment, is this really the pinnacle of civilization that Greenland might get its own US style strip mall? So that's out there. And I do think in everything we talk about, Venezuela, Greenland, and the rest of the world, Gaza, now whatever might happen in Iran, somewhere in the calculation is Donald Trump, the property developer, the businessman, the guy who's thinking about, what hotel can I build with my name on it? What golf course can I build? A lot of it should probably be seen through this prism.
Let me take a quick break here. We have to do station identifications and commercial messages. The sponsors must be obeyed.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and we are back again. And I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest, David Smith, Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspapers. And we're talking all things Donald Trump and the world, really. And we will talk about them as soon as I get my notes back, which have mysteriously vanished. There we are. And we were just describing the strip mall to be built in Newark in Greenland, with a McDonald's and a competing Wendy's and probably maybe a Nando's chicken too. That'd be kind of useful when you think about it. All kinds of possibilities. What's the Danish equivalent of fast food, I wonder? We'll see that too. Curiously, let's turn from the ice of Greenland to the ice of Minneapolis. Okay, that's a weak segue. I'm sorry, but I was trying to think of a way to do that. ICE, of course, is the American immigration enforcement mechanism, the government agency which hunts down, I guess is the right verb now, hunts down illegal immigrants or undocumented aliens. And the other day, one of their agents, one of their officers, managed to put three bullets into a protester who was driving her car, or had stopped her car, or was reversing her car on the street where the protest was taking place. It's not yet entirely clear what the action was, but a sane evaluation of this would have to say something along the lines of that was excessive force at the minimum, and potentially a violation of any standing orders that might exist for ICE officers, and certainly something that must be dealt with by the courts. And there are petitions, and there are public protests spreading across the country. Why is ICE becoming a force not just to be reckoned with, but a police type agency that is to be feared by normal citizens rather than people who have violated immigration law in some way? What has happened with this?
Yeah, and you mentioned a segue. I think there is a connection between Greenland and Minneapolis in the sense that Donald Trump is militarizing the US both outward and inward. This aggressive armed ambition, and he has talked about no greater threat to America than the enemy within. Left-wing radicals, the media, and so on. And you've seen troops on the streets of major US cities during his first term in office. And they're often the cities run by Democrats, liberals, Trump opponents. And of course, Minneapolis, of all places, many listeners may remember as the scene of the police murder of George Floyd 5 years ago. And that was followed by Black Lives Matter protests across the country. Now, ICE is the aggressor. And to answer your question, it has basically become this major security force that, with the latest legislation passed last year by Congress, massive budget increase, it is going to be bigger and have more money than many national armies of many countries. And it is, of course, zealously enforcing Trump's draconian immigration policies, something that he's talked about for the last decade, really central to his political identity. But as has been noted since the killing of Rene Good in Minneapolis, they often have ICE officers. Often have, less training than your typical police officer or army soldier. They're not experienced in de-escalation, for example, in incidents like this. I know from a Guardian colleague of mine who works in Minneapolis, who's interviewed activists, ICE officers will frequently point guns at them, and be unduly aggressive. And everyone who's been monitoring this says that it was a terrible tragedy, but not an entirely surprising one. This was a ticking time bomb. Something like this was bound to happen because the way ICE have clashed with protesters and sometimes just been unruly and out of order, they have become Trump's thugs on the ground frequently, and it's a very distressing thing to see.
We're talking about the training or lack thereof of ICE officers and their discipline in their duty while dealing with arrests or protests. It reminds me that oh goodness, back in 1971, when I was in the Army, way before most people seemed to be born, in my last week of basic training, we went through a whole series of drills about how we deal with riots, demonstrations, and protests, the right ways that formations do it, and how to respond without pointing your rifle at people and without shooting them. And somewhere along the way, these lessons seem to have disappeared. I watched the video of these ICE officers. They're standing around holding their weapons in this way and that way, not in formation, not even looking as if they are under some sort of command structure. That terrifies me because that means mistakes happen.
Yeah, and just two quick points. I think a lot of the ICE recruitment has been targeted at disgruntled young men who are high on testosterone and don't have many other opportunities, and in some cases might be politically radical, right wing, or discontented, or discontent, disconnected from society, or into guns, and ICE is giving them a home to release that anger at the world. And secondly, I think worth also highlighting with regards to ICE and the inhumane raid it's been carrying out on schools. There's been pictures of dragging pregnant women out of buildings. They've been snatching people off the streets. It's been pretty lawless, and worth remembering with Trump and the Department of Homeland Security and the age we now live in, so much of it is for the cameras and spectacle and drama and a glossy video they can put on their social media account that will delight the MAGA base, the Trump supporters, and no less importantly, shock and appall and provoke the liberals and the Democrats. So there's underpinning this, there's a huge amount of political theater and spectacle.
I think of it as performance politics.
Yep.
We're always on show, always eager to demonstrate strength, not necessarily thought through. And of course, that takes me back to my earlier comments about Venezuela, in which there didn't appear to be a whole lot of real planning about what happens after Mr. Maduro became a guest of the U.S. government, or sort of like. And now what? And the answer was a sort of a stunned silence. Well, we'll get to that. In the meantime, with all of this, a couple of issues seem to have almost melted away in the news world. I mean, the war in Ukraine continues, and it doesn't get the kind of play it was, and the peacekeeping or the peacemaking effort seems to have become ever less visible. And the conflict in Gaza barely gets a mention, and the peace plan has receded to a sort of a distant monument somewhere. Even as the attacks in Syria grow and the unrest, the protests, the citizen action in Iran seems to have now reached every province of the country. Are we in danger of allowing the cause of the day to overwhelm the way in which governments respond to longer-term questions and deeper, more complex issues? Are we now sort of governed by what's on the news, the last 60 minutes as the way of making decisions?
I mean, I suspect that's probably always been the case, but it certainly accelerated in the modern era with social media and so on. And Trump has often exploited it as well to push away stories like the Jeffrey Epstein files. And
Oh yes, I've forgotten about that.
that's right. One of the most important mantras of this time is, Steve Bannon on flooding the zone with shit, if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, I guess.
And overwhelming us. It's just kind of constant news all the time. I confidently predict that a week or two from now, Venezuela will feel like very old news, and it'll be kind of Nicolas Who, and people will say, gosh, that feels like a whole year ago that Maduro was captured, because we're in this constant churn. Certainly Ukraine keeps resurfacing, and on Friday, in the East Room, Trump said he's very disappointed in Putin and the way that is going. We did have a new initiative involving Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, a peace plan with Europe. But This does seem to drag on interminably, and Trump is yet to ask Russia for a major concession. Meanwhile, I think he would claim at least he's been more successful in Gaza, although the second phase of that peace plan, we are yet to see if it can be implemented. And there's, certainly some bumps in the road there. And you're absolutely right. Attention seems to have shifted. But I should just mention several weeks ago, I went to the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, which Trump has now renamed as the Trump Kennedy Center. And there was the Soccer World Cup draw. And of course, Trump was presented with the FIFA Peace Prize, a trophy that was a bit of a monstrosity. And but he gladly accepted it, which was a cunning move by FIFA to, make him feel better about not winning the Nobel Peace Prize, which he's still talking about, and
Constantly.
constantly. And of course, he claims to have solved, to have ended eight wars so far, including Gaza. But he admits he's surprised that Russia and Ukraine still eludes him. So Trump at least is keeping score, but essentially, yes, this feels like a world in turmoil, and every week there's something new, and what's happening in Iran right now is pretty astonishing.
And it becomes harder and harder to rack to rank these things in order of importance or horror or long-term impact. I mean, arguably, the unfortunate death of an activist woman in Minneapolis is less important than hundreds of thousands of deaths in Europe or the Middle East. Or Sudan, but like Stalin used to say, one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic.
And I forget what it is about. There were certainly cynical British journalistic phrases about how one local death in your own country compares to, thousands overseas. There's all sorts of odd scales at work here. In my experience, often the events that seem world-changing at the time come and go and don't tend to be that way. The number of times I've heard people say, "This changes everything," or, "the world will never be the same again." And a year later, you've kind of forgotten that event. I'm still surprised, for example, how we, many of us, have memory holes, to use a phrase in vogue, or try to forget the COVID-19 pandemic. It probably doesn't loom as large as it should. I mean, in America alone, 1 million people died, and obviously millions more around the world. And yet, just like the 1918 influenza pandemic, it hasn't left that much of a trace, or not as much as it should have done, perhaps. And everybody moves on. And I don't know if you saw it. This might be of personal interest to you. Over Christmas, I think Nate Silver, political commentator, got a bit bored, and he compiled a list of the most important 50 U.S. political events of the first quarter of the 21st century. And I thought it's quite interesting. Number one, he had the election of Donald Trump in 2016, and I think that's probably fair. That has been seismic and has changed so much of where we are. I think number two, he had 9/11. Again, hard to argue with that. And number three, he had Bush versus Gore in 2000, which certainly was massive at the time. And again, one can fantasize, if Al Gore had won that election, how many things would have happened differently or not happened at all.
Well, it might not have invaded Iraq.
I think that's probably that's the first one that leaps to mind, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm going to take a very quick station break, and this is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, delighted to have David Smith again from Washington. He's the Washington correspondent for the Guardian newspapers, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, delighted to have him rejoin us after some months, David Smith, the Guardian newspaper's Washington correspondent. And of course, as many of you know, long experienced in South Africa and Africa more generally. And we were just discussing the world-changing events that somehow recede from memory. And one of the things that comes to mind to me when we talk about the impact of Donald Trump's victory in 2016 and then his repeat victory in 2024 is that the American system inevitably also puts a midterm election in place during a presidential term of office. And that's coming up in 10 months and a couple of days, actually, when we think about it. And there is the thought among some commentators that it will lead to a Democratic win in the House of Representatives, the lower house, and just possibly in the Senate as well, although much less likely because of the way in which the seats that are up for re-election or election are either trending Democrat or Republican, or the incumbent is in a strong position. But will that change the way in which we think of the Trump revolution if he is suddenly, in the last 2 years of his presidency, restrained? So it is no longer Donald Trump unbound, it is Donald Trump restrained.
Yeah, I mean, this is the great paradox that from afar, Donald Trump can seem incredibly powerful and a strong man and running an imperial presidency and untouchable, unassailable, and so on. On the other hand, he's actually very unpopular in the polls and the surveys. His approval rating, sometimes it's down to like 36%, sometimes slightly a little higher. Maybe there are moments when he's kind of tied or slightly ahead of Joe Biden at the same stage, but historically, compared to past presidents, he's very weak. He's very unpopular, and that has been borne out in pretty much every election since Trump returned to power. Last year, for example, there were races for governor of the states of Virginia and New Jersey, and Democrats won those convincingly. They obviously won the mayoral race in New York. They've won lots of other special elections at state level. It's not a good time to be a Republican. And so all the signs are that Democrats should win the midterms comfortably in November. Admittedly, if anybody can blow it, it's probably the Democratic Party. But even so, certainly every pollster, every commentator I speak to does assume that the Democrats will win the House of Representatives. Just talked to someone the other day who predicted maybe 30 to 35 seats for the Democrats. Of course, they have the historical trend in their favor that Trump himself has been acknowledging recently, that the party of the sitting president usually takes a beating. The opposition are normally galvanized. As you say, the Senate is harder to call. I think in a normal year, probably Republicans would just about hold on because of the nature of the map. If things go spectacularly bad for them, then I guess they might lose that as well. And then, yes, I think things do start to look very, very different. Partly because Trump will be literally curtailed by Congress. They're not going to rubber stamp his legislation anymore. They will push back, and Democrats would have the power to investigate, to issue subpoenas, to hold committee hearings, to grill, cross-examine members of the Trump administration, theoretically, potentially even to impeach Donald Trump, although there's not a great appetite for that, having impeached him twice already in his first term. Number three, of course, would be another record if they went down that road. But I think a second reason the mood will change is just sheer the march of time, just the political calendar. After the midterms, Trump will be in the second half of his second presidency. Whoever it is, that tends to be seen as a lame duck period. And the media attention that Trump loves so much will inexorably shift to the question of his successor and who's going to run in 2028. And I've seen it so often, the headlines become consumed with, the vice president versus the secretary of state versus somebody else and what's going on the Democratic side. And you get into that election excitement. And I'm fascinated to see how Trump handles that. It's going to be very bruising for his ego to no longer be the center of attention. I do find it hard to imagine him graciously and magnanimously passing on the torch to a successor and holding rallies where he anoints someone as the next person. That doesn't feel like Trump's style. Obviously, every now and then he flirts with the idea of unconstitutionally running for a third term himself. A lot of people say, no, that's definitely not going to happen. I think after January the 6th, we should never rule anything out. It's not impossible, but as things stand, it does feel like last year and this year are the zenith of Trump's power, and that's why he's scrambling to get as much done as possible and being fast and furious. But November will be the beginning of the end.
And of course, there is the inevitability of biology. He'll be pushing 83 by that time. He will be a lesser man than he is now, if for no other reason that we all get old and older and older, and it becomes increasingly apparent that we can no longer do the things we used to do. I can no longer run a 4-minute mile, obviously. I'm not even sure I can run a mile, period. What you're leading me to, which is my last question for you, which I want to come back to just after this commercial break, and that, of course, is after Donald Trump, who? And we'll be right back after these messages. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest, David Smith, Guardian correspondent in Washington.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and David Smith, Donald Smith. Wonderful. You see what he does to you. David Smith, the Guardian newspapers, a periodic guest for us who helps unravel the mysteries of Washington and America more generally. Especially now, I guess it's important in the 250th anniversary of American independence, which will start to consume Americans soon enough as to what this anniversary really means. And there are already two competing committees which are trying to define this, and we're trying to figure out what kinds of activities are appropriate, necessary, useful, and urgent to make this anniversary have some meaning. In the middle of this stand the figures of J.D. Vance, your vice president, and Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, head of USAID, and apparently proconsul of Venezuela, if I read the newspapers correctly, as potential successors. There is nobody else in Trump's cabinet that seems to me to even have the remotest possibility of being a credible candidate. And if you look at the roster of senators and Republican governors, no name stands out, to me at least. The only other possibility might be somebody from the private sector who's not in government, who might say, "Wait a minute, I have the answers. I know how to run things. I built successful businesses, et cetera, et cetera." But that was the story that Donald Trump was selling too, some years back. So where are we?
Just very quickly on your previous point, I think there's another paradox with Trump's age and health because, on the one hand, he's just been saying that he takes too much aspirin because he does not want thick blood going through his heart. He's got very thin skin, literally, these days. Someone nicked his hand with her ring and he was bleeding. And there's all sorts of other little strange symptoms and doctor's visits. I think over the weekend he was at the dentist. And yet he can still talk for an hour and a half without sipping a glass of water. There's still a sort of strange, furious energy about him that Joe Biden didn't have. But in terms of the succession, I think Vice President J.D. Vance is the front runner. And every opinion poll suggests that. And anecdotally, that's the mood, and that's what people say. And even Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said that, if JD Vance is running, it's basically, he will be the candidate. And I think that will be interesting. I think, Democrats should be able to beat JD Vance, but I'd also warn them not to underestimate him. I've seen him give speeches and hold campaign events, and he hits some of the Trump buttons for sure, but he also brings his own elements and tries to be a bit more humorous sometimes, or be charming with people in the crowd. And he's quite good doing question and answers with the press afterwards, off the cuff. And notably, Vance really made himself the face of the government response to the shooting in by ICE in Minneapolis last week, and very aggressively went after the media, which was a Trump echo. But certainly, Rubio is another heavyweight contender. He's apart from Henry Kissinger, the only person ever to be both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. Obviously, he will look to something like Venezuela as a victory. He's been involved in other parts of the world as well, and got experience in the Senate previously. There are rumors and reports that Senator Ted Cruz of Texas will try running for president again, as he did in 2016. But otherwise, yeah, it's hard to see right now who else. There could be an entrepreneur. It could be maybe another go for Nikki Haley, who lost to Trump last time. But yeah, right now, it does appear that Vance is the favorite.
Well, for what it's worth, the photograph of the new ambassador designate for South to South Africa from the U.S., Brent Bozell III, the picture of his swearing in has Ted Cruz giving the oath of office
I saw that, yeah.
with a Texas flag, bit large and
Right.
in charge in the back. We're running out of time, David, and I'll give you a minute to wrap up. Give me your number one black swan event that we should pay attention to, which by definition means we can't predict it, but go ahead, predict it anyway.
Donald Trump resigns. That's probably just wishful thinking for millions of liberal Americans. But you're absolutely right. Impossible in a universe where Donald Trump is talking about invading Greenland, black swans are kind of impossible to imagine, aren't they? But I think yeah, the let's say somehow Trump and his allies strike a peace deal in Ukraine to everyone's surprise, and lo and behold, Trump fulfills his ambition to win the Nobel Peace Prize. So now I've said it, it kind of definitely won't happen, I think.
I now have this vision of an entire fleet, a flock of a bird, whatever swans are called, of black swans flying over the White House, flapping their wings furiously and going honk, honk. Courtesy of David Smith. David, it's a joy always to speak with you. I wish we could do it more often. David Smith, Washington correspondent for Guardian Newspapers. He is trying manfully to help us unravel the mysteries and obscurities in Washington and beyond. And we're going to call on him again in a couple of months, and we're going to talk about the 250th anniversary of American independence, what it means for America, but what it means for the world, and where do we go from there. David, again, thank you. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, in our new time at 11 on Monday morning, and the podcast of all of our shows available at the website. You have a good week, and we'll be back again with you folks in 1 week's time. Thank you for listening.